And thank you for listening on a Friday to Atlanta's NPR News Station, 88.5 GPB Atlanta. I'm Ricky Bevington here at Monday Night Garage on Lee Street in the West End. And if you're not busy tonight, come on down and join us. It's a gorgeous day. We're near the Atlanta University Center and the Atlanta Beltline West Side Trail. This place is family and pet friendly. There's a food truck if you're hungry. I've already spotted maybe 4 dogs and 5 babies and about 200 adults. So it's a family-friendly event, and of course, a brewery as well. And it is Friday. So in the next half hour, we're going to be meeting some of the people behind your favorite local beers. Their backgrounds may surprise you. Before we get to the fun stuff, however, we're going to take a moment to look at the bigger picture about alcohol, specifically its impact on health. GPB intern Issa Beth Mentosa is a master's student in public health at Emory University, and she says that Georgians actually drink less than our fellow Americans. Here's Issa Beth with some facts about how we drink.
Georgians binge drink less than the national average, and they have less drinks when they do. Having more than 4 or 5 drinks in a 2-hour span is considered excessive drinking by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And any alcohol used by pregnant women or people under 21 is also defined as excessive. Some of the negative health impacts of this type of consumption include increased risk of injury, violence, liver disease, and cancer. The CDC also says about 2,400 deaths a year in Georgia can be linked to excessive alcohol use. For GPB News, I'm Isabel Mendoza.
And Isabel has posted more facts about alcohol and public health on our website, gpb.org/alcohol. So when Spencer Nix attended the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, he made a promise never to drink alcohol while studying to become a non-denominational pastor. That is a promise he never fully kept, and instead he turned it into a business. He is now CEO and co-founder of Reformation Brewery in Woodstock. A few weeks ago, I visited Nix in his nondescript office filled with tents, branded coolers, and enough beer to last several months. Nix explained that the philosophy behind Reformation and now brewing beer is like pastoring a church.
Oh, yeah. So many ways that they overlap. When people often ask me, you know, how'd you go from pastoring a church to running a brewery? I'm like, well, it's actually pretty natural. You're still dealing with humans, and they're just as messy in the church as they are out in the world. And I actually prefer the messy humans. So in the brewing industry, in some ways, it's a little easier because most people know they're a mess. And that's a good place to start for a good conversation.
And you're bringing people together into community.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's just a natural attraction for people to come around. It's we say a lot of times beer is the first social media, sharing a beer together and getting to know each other apart from a screen. It carries incredible value for us.
Is that what the Reformation means in the title?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it started, you know, kind of silly because the other co-founder and I, we were drinking beers he was bringing home from Europe, and he and I share a common background and been to seminary. So after a few beers, you end up talking about God or politics. We were nerds, so we ended up talking about the Protestant Reformation and that time period in church history and what was going on in the world. So when we started homebrewing, we're like, well, what are we going to call this? Well, let's call it what we end up talking about anyway, the Reformation. But little did we know, you know, when we were homebrewing, what this would eventually become. But people identified with that moment of, you know, there's a reformer in all of us. And no matter what you're trying to change in the world, you're a reformer. And we want to celebrate that and draw that out.
While you were in school at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary,
yeah, don't laugh.
Did you drink alcohol?
Yes, in the closet. We were, there was quite a few of us. We, you know, broke our oaths not to, but again, there's a rebellious reformer in everyone, and we took the liberty to do it. We didn't think it was necessarily a great thing we should be promising anyway. So it was, you know, in your younger years, you test the boundaries, and we surely did, but we enjoyed it.
What kind of reactions have you had from within your faith community?
Yeah. Surprisingly, they've been very positive. You know, I had that fear growing up in this context that there would be a lot of backlash, that I would lose a lot of relationships and dear friends. And, you know, some of that's happened, but for the most part, I've gained people in my life that bring value, and they encourage me, and They've not told me you need to walk away from the faith or any of that. So I've taken their advice and I listened to them. But overall, the reaction has been very, very positive.
For those who haven't grown up in a teetotaling background, what's it like?
The pressure, I think we as humans like to put social pressure for a lot of different reasons to use as leverage for a lot of agendas. And, you know, it's just like pressure you might feel in your job or in your, you know, parenting. You never feel like you're good enough or accepted enough. And so you just fight those same insecurities that we all have as humans. You know, growing up in it, it didn't seem weird. It was just the way we treated it and the way it was viewed. But, you know, as I grew up and studied and saw the issue from a more historical context, it is a very, very small part of the narrative of how the church has viewed alcohol, how society has viewed alcohol. I mean, at the end of the day, it's really hard to get things to stop fermenting. We've only been able to do that relatively in the modern era. So we have all this history where you couldn't stop fermentation. And then for, you know, as culture developed, we found or a part of our segment said, no, we need to do everything we can to stop it. People are abusing it. And that's always going to be the case. But the solution to that, I think, can be more nuanced and advanced than prohibition only.
And you remain very active in your evangelical faith.
I do. I mean, it's an important part of who I am. It's part of my identity. I'm not ashamed of it at all. But saying that, you know, we're not a Christian brewery, and not because we're not ashamed of it, but this brewery has a lot of different partners, and we don't all share the same worldview and perspective. And I think that's what makes it more beautiful as well, being able to have those conversations and arguments and fight for our values and visions. And it makes us better overall as a company.
Will you show me your brewery?
Absolutely. I'd love to. All right, we're walking into our keeping room. We call it a keeping room and not a tasting room again because it's about why we do what we do. The keeping room historically was the room beside the kitchen, where you would have your conversations. It's where community would happen. And that's what we want to celebrate, not just the tasting of beer, but the community around beer. So we call it our keeping room. And then we'll enter into our production area, which is a glorified kitchen. All right, we're entering our production area. As you can hear, that's the canning line, the canning machine that's making all this loud noise. We are canning Cadence today. Cadence is one of our top-selling products in the market. We are distributed throughout the state of Georgia, and we're going to package probably about 900 cases of Cadence today.
This looks like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is. It is. A lot of moving parts, so please be careful. It is a working brewery. It's slippery. Don't want anybody to get hurt. But yeah, you can see this is our canning process. It's a lot of heavy lifting. There's you know, pallets of cans that go into a depalletizer, make their way down a nice slide, and get filled. We do about 45 cans per minute, and that's when everything is working optimally. Also, it takes three humans to work the machine, so it's three jobs we're supplying to our local community.
Is this like walking into your church?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, you know, it's sometimes you have to stop and try to get it, rise above it. Because in the day-to-day, it's just hard work. But when you sit back, you have these conversations, it makes you very proud of what you've created and what you're supplying for these people who are working, as well as the community that gets to enjoy it.
Well, we'll let you get back to work. Thank you so much, Spencer Nix.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Spencer Nix is co-founder and CEO of Reformation Brewery. You can learn more about the company and why Nix wants to, quote, set beer free. Just visit our website, gpb.org/alcohol. Like Nix, many people wrestle with faith and consuming alcohol. It's not just Southern Baptists, Muslims, Mormons, Buddhists. Many religions restrict or ban booze. I invite you to share your story about faith and alcohol on Twitter and Facebook at Ricky Bevington. We're here in the West End, and today's show is all about exploring what, when, why, how Georgians drink alcohol. Joining me right now, about for the next 10 minutes, is one of the men behind Monday Night Brewing. This is Jonathan Baker, and he is co-founder. Oh, you're getting a little applause. Wonderful. You're probably a familiar face around here. Jonathan is a co-founder of Monday Night Brewing and also the chief marketing officer. And my first question, of course, is what is the history of this place? And of course, you have to tell us about the name.
Yeah, sure. So back in 2006, I was in a Bible study, back to religion, with two of my co-founders and some other guys. And we met at Friday mornings at 6 a.m., which is just a horrible time of day.
Wow.
I know. Yeah.
And Friday.
turns out we didn't know each other that well, and that's not a great time to get to know someone. So we started homebrewing on Monday nights. We picked a Monday night, made our first batch of beer. It turned out drinkable. So we tried again and just kept rolling. And then 5 years later in 2011, we started a brewery.
So how do you go from becoming just being a group of guys talking about the Bible, brewing beer, to launching a business? That's a big step.
It is a big step, and that's frankly why it took us 5 years. It's a big step made up of a lot of little steps in between, and particularly in a state like Georgia where, you know, the alcohol laws are so convoluted. It actually took us a while just to learn what we needed to do in order to make that happen. We spent 5 years teaching ourselves how to brew. We talked to different distribution partners, interviewed retailers, developed our brand, we started blogging, and, you know, most importantly, I think we started developing a following by inviting people into our garage on Monday nights to brew with us. And that was when we kind of really fell in love with not only the process of brewing, but the community of beer and just the beverage as kind of a kickstarter of relationships.
Just like we heard from Reformation Brewery's founder, Spencer Nix, about how it's a little bit like pastoring a church, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So weekends are overrated. How did you come up with that, other than it's a great jump off the Monday night brewing theme?
Weekends are overrated is our slogan, and it kind of sums up just how we got started. So we were all white collar guys working 9-to-5s. You know, we'd wear neckties to work, we'd come home from work on our Monday, loosen our ties ceremoniously before we brewed beer, and we started actually looking forward to Mondays. And it was at that point when we realized, oh, we really need to be doing something with our lives that we love, that we enjoy. And so it's not necessarily about putting down the weekend, but more like lifting up the weekday and saying, make every day great, make every day something that you're proud of.
In fact, at your first location, there's an entire wall of ties, and I've always wondered, were those contributions from your drinking community? How did you build that?
One or two, but they were actually all donated from folks that visited the brewery.
Oh, wonderful. So people would just bring a tie.
A lot of stories on that wall. A lot of people got married at the brewery and, you know, wrote a little note on the tie and tacked it up there.
And tell us where your other location is.
Our other location, our original location, is in West Midtown, right off Howell Mill and 75, kind of adjacent to the Waterworks.
So why did you guys decide to commit to the West Side for your locations?
Yeah, so, you know, a few reasons, but I think most importantly, we wanted to come to a location that really spoke to our purpose as a company, which is to deepen human relationships over some of the best beer in the country. And so we were looking for a location that, you know, not only had obviously space for us to store all these barrels and do all these fun things with beer, but that could become a gathering space for folks in the community. And the West End is, you know, full of these vibrant neighborhoods, very historic area, but there hasn't been as much commercial development as there has been residential development. And, you know, we wanted to provide a place for people to just hang out, have a meeting, enjoy each other, maybe get to know someone new. And, you know, the Beltline's coming through here too, and that's frankly a big part of why we're here.
The Beltline Westside Trail just opened, and you can see it pretty much from the bar. And speaking of community, there's probably 300 people here right now. I think it's a pretty good testament to the kind of crowd that you can draw here.
Or that you can bring.
Well, thank you very much. I hope a few of you are here to watch public radio. For our listening audience who's not here in the room with us and hearing the dogs barking, this is a pet and kid-friendly place. We are at Monday Night Garage, and I'm having a conversation with co-founder and chief marketing officer Jonathan Baker. Community, as you said, is a huge theme for your business. And I'm looking around and I see a lot of tables with a lot of people surrounding the tables. And I understand that group tables with a lot of people is an intentional thing, as well as no live music.
Yeah, so we're pretty intentional about how we design our tap rooms, and I can say tap rooms now because we have two, in order to grow community. So a couple things we do, we have these really long 12-foot picnic tables that hopefully encourage people that don't know each other to sit together. We also don't have live music at the brewery, and until now we didn't really have live radio, so
first for everything.
We don't want, you know, the music to be the focal point. We want people to talk to each other, get to know each other better.
Well, I think that public radio is all about bringing people together as well. So I think it's very appropriate that we're here broadcasting, and we're so grateful to have you. You also have games.
We do. I mean, drinking games are always fun, right? You know, the fun thing about having games at a brewery is you have to make sure you have one-handed games so that people can hold a beer. So shuffleboard, cornhole, games like that, Jenga.
And you're drinking a beer right now. What is it?
Yeah, it's delicious.
Do you know which one it is?
This is Petit Déjeuner. It's a spontaneous sour we did back in the fall.
I would imagine as chief marketing officer, you have a lot of fun coming up with the names of your beers. Is there an art and science to that, the naming?
Yeah, we get everyone involved. I have final say. But the brewers are actually, you know, they think about these beers. And a lot of the beers we're making here take years. So they have a lot of time to think about names. I think my favorite name thus far is Tears of My Enemies.
Who came up with that one?
That was me.
Very nice. You are the chief marketing officer, after all. Thank you so much to Jonathan Baker, who is also a co-founder here at Monday Night Garage, where we're broadcasting live. This is 88.5 GPB Atlanta. Thank you for joining me, Jonathan.
Thanks for being here.
So, craft breweries may be having a moment right now, for sure. But the mimosa has long been in style. It's an uncomplicated cocktail, equal parts fresh squeezed orange juice and dry sparkling wine or champagne. Beth McKibben is the editor of food blog Eater Atlanta, and her words about cocktails have appeared in Atlanta Magazine, Southern Kitchen, and Liquor.com. She says, while there's no mixing or serious bartending involved in creating a mimosa, it is still a serious drink.
The drink's simple yet courtly qualities lend themselves well to morning consumption, acting as a sort of mood-lifting, waking concoction full of fizz and bright citrusy acid with a natural sugary undertone. It's almost as if you're sipping the sunrise. Like so many drinks we sip and savor, the mimosa's origin story is muddled. The cocktail's life seems to have begun in London in 1921, not as itself, but rather as its predecessor, the Buck's Fizz. The Buck's Fizz, created by bartender Pat McGarry of the aptly named Buck's Club, consists of two parts champagne and one part orange juice. It's served in a long tumbler rather than the fluted glass associated with these cocktails today. The Buck's Fizz first appears in print in 1930 when a bartender by the name of Harry Craddock listed it in his one and only book, The Savoy Cocktail Book, named for the famed London Hotel for which he worked. The mimosa's actual beginning is far less clear than that of the Buck's Fizz, but most cocktail historians agree it was likely created by bartender Frank Meyer in 1925 at the Ritz Hotel in Paris. Meyer published his own book in 1936, Artistry of Mixing Drinks, where he lists both the Buck's Fizz and a new stirred cocktail he names the Mimosa, or Champagne Orange. This cocktail called for a cube of ice in a wine glass, fresh juice from half an orange, and equal parts champagne. In the advent of home refrigeration, the ice was likely dropped as all of the ingredients can now be served properly chilled. Sadly, the mimosa's pleasant charm has somehow morphed over the decades into a quick and dirty vehicle for cheap OJ and even cheaper sparkling wine. The mimosa's ingredients do matter because there's nowhere to hide. Using fresh squeezed orange juice, which carries a lighter texture, brighter flavor, and lacks the heft of added sweeteners, paired with a dry, sparkling wine of equal caliber, makes all the difference in the drink. The mimosa isn't meant to send you staggering into the sunlight. Everything worthwhile takes time. Even when it comes to the simple act of mixing cold orange juice with chilled champagne in a glass during brunch.
Beth McKibben is the editor of food blog Eater Atlanta and was a contributing writer for Liquor.com. So many Atlanta brunch spots promise bottomless mimosas. You may prefer Bloody Marys, wine spritzer, just black coffee. That's my style, little milk. What is your brunch personality? We have a quiz on our website. You can take it, gpb.org/alcohol. Still to come on tonight's show, how brunch evolved from a feast for hunting elites into a decadent weekend meal. Students talk about choosing a sober college experience. And my live interview with Monday Night Brewing's chief operating officer about the business of beer. You can follow along on today's show on Facebook and Twitter at GPB News and Ricky Bevington. It is not too late to join us here at Monday Night Garage. The address is 933 Lee Street near the Atlanta University Center. I'm Ricky Bevington, live from the West End. This is 88.5 GPB Atlanta.